Revelation 16. We've left off in Revelation 16, verse 16. This is where John introduces us to the subject of Armageddon. Now, in the religious world, a lot of people have a lot to say about Armageddon. The Bible has a lot less to say than people often say about it. So we are going to spend a fair amount of time on this word and this verse, as it is something that's commonly discussed in our society. Revelation 16, 16 says, "And they gathered them together into the place which is called in Hebrew Armageddon." Now, today, as you look at a lot of the people in our world, they have, as I said, various ideas about this. For many, Armageddon in their mind conjures up some massive battle at the end of time. There's going to be the Lord, and there's in the minds of many. I'm not saying that I believe this or the Bible teaches this, but in the minds of many, there will be Jesus, there will be the Antichrist, and there's going to be this great secular conflict. The Lord, of course, is going to, in the minds of many, win this battle. And after the battle with the Antichrist finishes, the Lord supposedly is going to reign for 1,000 years on the earth. Some think that there's going to be an additional opportunity for people to receive salvation, and it's going to be just a really, really interesting time. Well, all that stuff is fascinating for a lot of reasons, one of which is this. How much does John say about Armageddon in the verse that we just read? Not very much. I mean, it's very brief. Then we have this additional point. Do you want to guess how many times we read about Armageddon in the Bible? Just once. And it's right here in Revelation 16, 16. So when people talk about Armageddon and they say that there are going to be these, squadrons of airplanes, and there's going to be these tank battalions, and there's going to be these missiles with atomic warheads and all these other things, where are you getting that from? You have to kind of start here and then start tossing in some other passages which don't relate to what we find in Revelation 16, 16 to come up with all that kind of stuff. And then, too, you have this issue. When you think about God, if there's going to be a great conflict, if there were, which, again, I don't believe and I don't think the Bible teaches this, but if there were to be a great physical conflict, do you think God needs a squadron of airplanes? No. You think he needs missiles with nuclear bombs? No, he doesn't need that kind of stuff. I mean, he speaks the word and they're toast. So even from a common sense standpoint, people should realize that what's often taught about this particular word is simply not true. Now, if you have a translation like the ASV, you'll have an H there. King James, New King James, maybe some other translations, you'll not see the H. In other translations, it's just Armageddon. You have the A with the ASV, though, and maybe some others you do have the H. When people talk about Armageddon, again, I think it's more out of ignorance than anything else. They seem to assume that this information is filled, is throughout the Bible. Scripture is literally filled with information about it. But that's not true. As we said, we've got the word only used here. And even the place, if you will, there's limited information about it. We do, in the Old Testament, read about the plain or the valley of Megiddo. And this seems to be what John is alluding to for reasons that we'll make clear in just a couple of minutes. But we do find 2 Chronicles 35, verse 22. Also in the book of Zechariah, chapter 12, verse 11, Old Testament references that would seem to point us to this plain or this particular area. And that, of course, would be the plain. That would be the valley of Megiddo. Now, if you can find a map, the Jezreel Valley there in the lower section of Galilee, that's the area that we're talking about. We have seen this as far as some of the material in our vacation Bible school. This is important because it was an area that connected some key trade routes. In this day and time, it would have been the connecting highway between Egypt and Mesopotamia. And as you look at the Old Testament background for this, and this seems to be why John uses this particular word to describe this area. Armageddon, or this valley, this plain, this area, was a place that was associated with a lot of different battles. That kind of starts out in the books of Joshua and Judges, and then there are several others. The first time that we read about it is Joshua 12, verse 21. And then as you continue to move forward, the time of Joshua, the time of the conquest, you find in Joshua 17, verse 11, that there was a temporary victory by Israel over the king of Megiddo, and the conflicts just continued as you look at the Old Testament history. Because what's like today, if you've got an area of territory that is a river, or if it is a key land so people can pass from here to there, what's going to happen with that property? All right, the value is going to go up. Everybody is going to want to buy it. If you live in a less civilized society where people don't buy property, what's going to happen?
Take it.
All right, we're going to try to take it. That's what happened with this particular area. As you go back and you look at human history, you find that a lot of different peoples controlled this area. The Egyptians controlled it for a while. The Canaanites controlled it for a while. The Philistines controlled it for a while. The Israelites controlled it for a while. The Assyrians, the Persians, the Greeks, the Romans. All these people conquered Megiddo. Now, if you can get that in your mind as far as this is a place of great conflict. This is a place where forces have come together in the past to do battle. And some of the battles were very, very well known. When you think about Gideon, the Midianites, over there in the book of Judges, chapter 7, verse 1, well, this was in that area of Megiddo. When you think about the death of Saul and his sons, they were out there on the eastern extremity of this area, this plain. They were killed by Philistines. That also was in the area of Megiddo. Now, this is another passage. Let's have somebody run back to 2 Chronicles 35. We'll look initially at 2 Chronicles 35, verses 20 to 24. And after we get this information before us, this is about the death of a king. This was King Josiah. We'll then look at what we find in 2 Chronicles 35, verse 25. 2 Chronicles 35, 20 to 24, initially. Who wants to take care of that? Lois.
After all this, when Josiah had set the temple in order, Necho, king of Egypt, came up to make war at Carchemish on the Euphrates, and Josiah went out to engage him. But Necho sent messengers to him, saying, "What have we to do with each other, O king of Judah? I am not coming against you today, but against the house with which I am at war, and God has ordered me to hurry. Stop for your own sake from interfering with God who is with me, that he may not destroy you." However, Josiah would not turn away from him, but disguised himself in order to make war with him. Nor did he listen to the words of Necho from the mouth of God, but came to make war on the plain of Megiddo.
Okay, there.
Is that it?
Yeah, and then we'll pick up 25 in just a second. Here it is, Josiah, involved in a military conflict. We have there the plains, or we have the valley there of Megiddo, that is this area of Armageddon. There is this battle. And then notice this little detail in verse 25.
Then Jeremiah chanted a lament for Josiah, and all the male and female singers speak about Josiah in their lamentations to this day.
Now there it is. Thank you. He did an excellent job. All right. This king dies. There was a lamentation. There was a memorial about this king in this battle. How long? Till this day. So this area had great history associated with it when it came to military conflict. There are some days, there are some battles, there are some events where it's just a perpetual memorial. When we see this, when we hear this, instant things. You know, 4th of July, what comes to your mind?
Fireworks.
Fireworks. And probably some patriotism, too, along with that. But instantly, there are some things that just jump into the mind. So for these people, when their minds were drawn back to this in 2 Chronicles, the reading that was done, very, very good illustration of this. I mean, this was the place of conflict. This was the place of battle. Today we use different illustrations. You know, this is Waterloo. Or this, you know, we talk about Iraq. Or we talk about 9/11. Those same kinds of things. That one description instantly summarizes everything. For these people, Armageddon symbolized battle. Well, there's some other things that are helpful as we try to figure out exactly what this word Armageddon is specifically referring to. The Hebrew word har, H-A-R, means hill or mountain. Now, this is significant, and I think it's one of the things one author said that this destroys the vision. When you think about a hill or mountain, you're talking about an area that is substantially higher than the surrounding area. If you go back to this area, though, you find that there is a height there of only about 70 feet. What kind of mountain is that? It's not a mountain, not even really a good hill. So when you realize that, you know, John says, you know, the Battle of Armageddon, you know, you have here the mountain, if you will, you have here the hill. He can't be talking about, when you go back and you look at this area, the topography, the geography of the land, it just doesn't match up. It's not a mountainous area, but it's not absolutely flat, but it's kind of flat. So that's another hint that John is saying. We're using a symbol that describes a great battle, a symbol that describes a great conflict, but it's not something that's going to be associated with life on earth. Armageddon or Harmageddon, whichever translation you prefer, and this goes back to what we have in Zechariah 12, verse 11. It seems to describe this hill of sorrow. That is, there's going to be a great sorrow for people. Well, if you look at where we are, as far as the plagues, you have a further hint as far as what we're talking about. Notice, I think it's back in verse 12. And the sixth, he poured out his bowl of wrath. And then, as you move through the chapter, you come to verse 7, or 17. And the seventh poured out his bowl of wrath. Do you remember what we said about the seventh seal, the seventh trumpet, and the seventh plague? All right, we there have, you know, basically Christ has come. We've got the end of time. And we've said that sixth one takes us up to the end of time. Well, John has essentially finished the sixth seal. He's getting ready to introduce the seventh seal. So time-wise, where does that put Armageddon? That's putting us, you know, at the end of time, the Lord's return and so forth. And that's one more clue as far as what we are dealing with here. I'm suggesting, when you think about this word, conflict, the sorrow that seems to be associated with this word, what's going to be the greatest conflict or the greatest sorrow that people ever experience?
Lack of salvation.
All right. Or hell. When the Lord finally comes and people realize that they have no hope. I mean, it's bad to be in Hades right now. If you're with the rich men and suffering, that's not a pleasant experience. But whatever they know there, apparently, more is on the way as far as punishment. And it seems to me that they know that that is a temporary holding spot. And sometimes people can say, my circumstances right now are not good, but we hope that in the future things are going to get better. But if we're on the wrong side of Hades when we die, then obviously the only thing that awaits is something that's far, far worse, and that is going to be hell. So Armageddon, if you want a simple definition for it, hell, he talks about people being gathered together. And I think that's one of the things that a lot of people miss. Let's go back and look at 16 again. And they gathered them together into the place which is called in Hebrew, Armageddon. There's nothing there in verse 16 about a battle. It doesn't talk about the people fighting. It simply says they're collected. They're gathered together. And that's exactly what we have seen elsewhere in the book of Revelation. At the right time, people are going to be gathered together. It's really not unlike what Jesus said in Matthew 25, verse 41. You have all the nations gathered together before him. And then those on the left hand, what will the Lord say to them? Right, depart from me, ye cursed, into the eternal fire. You know, we never had any relationship. I never knew you. So off you go. And that's exactly what is right. We've talked about, from the standpoint of the trumpets, the warnings. When we looked at that sixth trumpet, we pointed out that God warns people about sin. This isn't something that you want to be involved with. Well, if you fail to heed that warning about sin, guess what? In the tank you go. As far as Armageddon, you're going to face this great destruction at the end of time. A lot of people look at Armageddon as a future battle, but I would be more inclined to describe it as the result. It's going to be that place where people are gathered. There's going to be that great sorrow. It's going to be what people have brought upon themselves because of their choice. Now, as you look at this, you can see how it relates to some of the other things that we've studied. Let's back up to the previous chapter for just a minute. And see what we find. I had Revelation 15:2. Yeah. And I saw, as it were, a sea of glass mingled with fire. And them that come off how? Victorious from the beast, and from his image, and from the number of his name, standing by the sea of glass, having harps of God. So here you have the righteous people. They've made their choice. And they're going to, in this life and in eternity, be blessed for it. And then after you get through Revelation 16, if you turn across the page, Revelation 17, verse 14. These shall war against the Lamb shall overcome them. For he is the Lord of lords, the King of kings, and they shall overcome that are with him. They're called, they're chosen, they're faithful. So throughout this book, and especially in this immediate context, John is talking about two different choices. You can choose. Earlier, we had Jesus, he's the Lamb, standing on Mount Zion with 144,000. We can be on the side of right, or we can be on the side of wrong. And if we're on the side of wrong, then of course we're going to be condemned. Paul dealt with the same kind of thing, and this is why I've said throughout the class that as we look at what we find in Revelation, the basic points are you have the good guys, you have the bad guys, and here are the consequences for both. You have oftentimes in this book information that's taught elsewhere in the Bible. It's just usually in other places taught in a more literal way. In Ephesians 5:6, Paul talked about being, you know, the sons of disobedience and so forth. Well, that's what John's talking about here. If you make that choice, Armageddon is going to be what you experience. We also saw this if you back up even a little bit more. Remember in Revelation 14, the end of the chapter, we there talked about things that are going to take place at the end of time. We talked about the Lord having that sickle, and then in verses 17 through 20, we talked about the unrighteous. And notice how 17 through 20 lines up real well with the description of Armageddon. And another angel came out, this is 14:17, came out from the temple, which is in heaven. He also having a sharp sickle. And another angel came out from the altar, he that hath power over fire. And he called with a great voice to him that had the sharp sickle, saying, Send forth thy sharp sickle, and gather the clusters of the vine of the earth, for her grapes are fully ripe. And the angel cast forth his sickle into the earth, and gathered the vintage of the earth, and cast it into the winepress, the what? The great winepress of God. Well, Armageddon, it's time for you to be punished. It's the same thing, it's just being described with different terms and different figures. And the winepress was trodden without the city, and there came out blood from the winepress, even under the bridles of the horses, as far as 1,600 furlongs. You're probably really tired of me saying this, but I'm going to mention it again. John, he is a writer. He tells you something, and then he turns right around and tells you again from a different perspective. And then he tells you again, and tells you again, and tells you again. So if we can get our minds wrapped around that approach to the book, that's going to help us and help us greatly as we look at a lot of different things. Anything that went out or asked before I say a little bit more? Okay. Now, as you look at what we have here, as far as Armageddon, there in 16:16, you can see how we, let's see, let's back up just a little bit to 15, the preceding verse, which we talked about last week. The Lord said, Behold, I come as a thief. That's going to be the end of time. Blessed is he that does what? All right, you're watching, you're staying awake, you're keeping your garments, lest you walk naked and see your shame. The Lord says, I'm going to return. You can be in a right relationship with me. There is no reason to be ashamed. There is no reason to be caught off guard because you know how to live. If you don't live correctly, verse 15, what's going to be the consequence? Armageddon, verse 16. So a lot of people, if they would simply go back and read what precedes Revelation 16:16, they would have a pretty good clue. So if you like marginal notes, you might, you know, make a note between verse 15 and 16. Armageddon, the place for the unsaved, and the opposite of the people who are walking, watching, and doing the things that are right. Anything else that you want to add or ask before we tie in some other passages? Okay, let's see. Let's go back and look at some other things, which, as I said, show that John's doing the same kind of thing again and again. Do you remember back then Revelation 13? It's Revelation 13, verse 4. He talked about those who worship the dragon because he gave his authority unto the beast. And they worship the beast, saying, Who's like unto the beast? Earlier in the book as well, but we can see if we just move back a few chapters, John is talking about the choices of the unsaved. Even back in Revelation 7. If you go back a little bit more, this is the chapter where we have the different tribes and the sealing and so forth. Verses 1 through 3. After this, I saw four angels standing at the four corners of the earth, holding the four winds of the earth, that no wind should blow on the earth or on the sea upon any tree. And I saw another angel ascend from the sun rising, having the seal of the living God. And he cried with a loud voice to the four angels, to whom it was given to hurt the earth and the sea, saying, Hurt not the earth, neither the sea, nor the trees, till we have done what? We've sealed. Well, you have God's people being described as people who are sealed. You have the unsaved being described or portrayed as those who are not sealed. At least not sealed with the seal of God and so forth. Revelation 6, verses 12 through 16, we talked about that verse a little bit last week as well. You know, they're going to be gathered, they're going to be collected at the right time. So, again and again, pictures of the saved, the lost, and for those who are not on the side of right, they are going to face Armageddon. A little bit more to say about the verse, but once again, we'll pause and see if there's anything that you want to add or ask. Okay. Let's take a look at that passage one more time. 16:16. And they gather them, that's the part that I want to talk about now, and they gather them together in the place which is called in Hebrew Armageddon, or King James, Armageddon. Who do you think is doing the gathering?
It says people die, not as a thief.
Well, that's a possibility, and some translations may have the singular in verse 16. Other translations, like the ASV, have the plural. There's a manuscript variation there. So, could be a reference to deity. If it's not a reference to deity, it's got to be a reference to... All right, or, you know, the good or the bad folks. So, whether you think that that's deity, angels, we've got the righteous and the unrighteous. One possibility that I kind of lean towards is that this is a devil. As you think about Satan, what's his ultimate goal? All right, he wants to get his... I mean, he knows where he's going, right? Remember when Jesus cast out some demons, they asked this question, are you here to do what before the time? Have you come to torment us? Have you come to get us before the time? So they know that this is going to be their end. No question about that. But as Scott said, their goal, because they can't change their ultimate circumstance, their goal is to drag as many people with them as possible. So if you prefer the singular, he, in verse 16, I think maybe that may refer to the devil. If you take the plural, they, that may refer to the devil and his helpers. But you have here the picture. Satan is trying to collect. He's trying to gather his helpers, perhaps, as well. They're trying to assemble as many people as they can into that group that's one day going to be judged. And they start very early. When we look at some of the stuff that's taking place in our world right now, you know, kindergarten and even before. So the devil and his helpers have a very, very clear plan. John, as he's soon going to deal with the, this will be at the end of the chapter, as he deals with this seventh plague. And we'll just read it now, but we'll probably not comment on it extensively until next week. But notice what we have there as far as the seventh plague. We'll just pick up with verse 21. And great hail, everyone about the weight of a talent, about 100 pounds, came down out of heaven upon men. And men blasphemed God because of the plague of the hail, for the plague thereof is exceeding great. Well, he's not talking about something that's going to take place on the earth. People are not one day going to be hit with 100-pound hailstones. But it is that image once again. Remember Revelation 14? If you're headed to hell, it's going to be like that image of a wine press. You're going to be squeezed. Here in Revelation 16, Armageddon, it's going to be like a mountain of sorrow or a hill of sorrow. You're going to face sorrow that is worse than anything that you've ever faced if you're on the losing side of things when it comes to the spiritual life. And then another illustration in Revelation 17, verse 21, it's going to be like having your body smacked with 100-pound hailstones. So we often think about Jesus and what he said when it comes to hell. He talked about the weeping and the gnashing of teeth. He said back there in Matthew chapter 5, it's better to cut off a hand, it's better to cut off a leg than to lose your eyes and go to hell. So John picks up on those same themes, only he talks about hell in ways which are a lot more graphic and uses language which is not really used elsewhere in the New Testament. But he wants to convey to people as they read this book, we're in a spiritual conflict, we're in a spiritual war, and you really need to make the right choices. Otherwise, you're going to face some serious, serious consequences. One other quick point, and then we'll see if there's anything that you want to ask. As you look at the six plagues, and we've gone through now all six of them, these six warn people that you really want to do what's right and have fellowship with God. Otherwise, Armageddon, hell, is going to be what you face. And as you look at the six plagues, and I'm going to highlight them again for you quickly, in that first plague, John said you don't want to be a follower of false religion. A lot of false religion exists. Some of it is quote-unquote Christian. Some of it is very anti-quote-unquote Christian, but that's the first plague. And then as you look at the second plague, he talks about those who reject religion. Sometimes people say, well, I'm just not that interested in religion. John says if you choose that, you're also going to suffer some terrible consequences. Ultimately, that's going to be Armageddon. The third plague describes false teaching. The fourth plague was going to be ignoring the power of the gospel. You have the next one, the fifth plague, being involved with some kind of evil civil government that involves the opposition of God's people. And then that sixth plague, John pretty much sums everything up, and we'll talk about this a little bit this morning. People can live their lives in such a way where the slightest spiritual interest, what do they do with the spiritual life in the worst case scenario? We talk sometimes about people who reach that point of no return. Sometimes what happens to that spiritual interest in a person's life? It dies. I mean, there's nothing left. There is no spark there. It's like you've got a fire, and you've had 5 days of rain. Well, can you go out and rekindle the fire just by stirring the coals a little bit? It's gone. It's dead. You know, there's no hope. As as long as you're just working with that leftover wood and so forth. And that's what John says in that sixth plague. If you fall into these categories, you're going to face Armageddon. Now, we know that God's patient. Romans 2:4 says that he's patient. He's long-suffering with people. He doesn't want people to get to this point. But there are some people that refuse to change, and they end up in this situation. As you look back a little bit in Revelation 16:9, talked about the men who were scorched with heat. That is, God's word affected them, and they didn't appreciate what they picked up from the scriptures. They blasphemed the name of God, who hath the power over these plagues. And notice there at the end of verse 9, they didn't do what? They repented not. Well, that's the key. People are not willing to right their relationship with God. This great battle, if you will, at the end of time is going to come. And the Lord will say, depart from me, ye cursed, into the eternal fire, prepared for the devil and his angels. Anything you want to discuss over what we've talked about so far? Steve?
When you ask about who they were, could they go back to verse 12?
Okay.
But would it be the kings?
You could see some association with that. We talked about the Euphrates River, and we mentioned that a lot of times today, you think about the Old West, and you have the people over here with the cattle. They need to be over here to head down to Texas. But that river, as they look at that, I mean, it'll give some water for the cattle, but what else does it do?
Yes.
Right. There's that barrier. Well, today we have a barrier that separates people. What's that barrier that separates the saved from the lost? Anybody remember? Well, that is one of the things, and the Bible would also include that in the answer. The gospel, how we respond to the gospel is going to put us on this side or this side. But if people, and that again goes back to what we're talking about before, if they eliminate that barrier, if they take the gospel out of their life, we don't want to have any spiritual life, we want to completely do away with the spiritual part of life, what happens to their spiritual being? It dies. It dries up. And if you take the gospel, and you can do this with society at large, but if you take the gospel out of the life of a person, if you get rid of all the spiritual inclinations, if you divest a person of everything that's related to religion, is anything going to fill up their life?
Not really?
Yeah. Sin's going to come flooding in, will it not? I mean, you're taking down the barrier. You're removing, that river is dried up. There's nothing there left to hold anything back. And that gives Satan a wide opening to just say, we're going to overcome you. And that seems to be the point there. And when you think about what we have here as far as Armageddon, if you make that choice where you try to eliminate every spiritual spark, everything that is related to, you know, the spiritual side of life. You know, the Old Testament says, back in the book of Ecclesiastes, God has set eternity. Anybody remember where? God set eternity in the
heart.
So God created man with a spiritual capacity. We're created with a spiritual dimension. But sometimes people have it in their idea, we're just going to completely, and it's not necessarily truth, it's just any religion, we're going to get rid of it. And if people make that choice, then they kind of seal their fate. We've heard people talk about and discuss reaching the point of no return, and that's one way to do it. If you divest all divest all spiritual interest in life from your existence. So I do see a connection between the two. Scott or Betty? Scott, did you have a thought? Okay.
In reading through this, could you kind of eliminate verse 15 when you're reading through it? You kind of connect quicker that it is Satan, I think.
Yes. The ESV actually puts that in parentheses,
yes,
as almost a parenthetical thought. So you're right. If you do just kind of, well, okay, this is part of thought. And if you think through it, you can see why it's there. Because you have this choice, you have this choice. But it is a very logical thought that you can see. And we know from other passages in the New Testament what's going to happen to the unrighteous. And this stuff is not predicting what's going to happen in, you know, 2015 or however long the world lasts, if we're here another 100 years or 1,000 years. But it is the same basic information that we have elsewhere in the New Testament. It's just expressed in a drastically different way. Bessie? Okay. Okay. If that exhausts our hands on Armageddon, let's pick up then with a little more information, verses 17 and 18. Now we finished up with the sixth trumpet, Armageddon, so now we're ready for the seventh plague, the seventh bowl of wrath. And as we said, with the sixth seal and the sixth trumpet brings us to Christ, he's come, and so forth, and now events after that. And the seventh poured out his bowl upon the air. And there came forth a great voice out of the temple from the throne, saying, "It is done." And there were lightnings and voices and thunders, and there was a great earthquake, such as was not since there were men upon the earth. And then the rest of 18. So great an earthquake to the mighty. Okay, we've got here, as I said, information about what is going to take place after the Lord returns at the end of time. You see that indicated, I think, by verse 17. John says, "It is, it's done, it's finished." Now, this is helpful information, and I want to give you these parallels. If you want to write these down and take a look at them at a later time, this is, in my mind, one of the keys to the book. Let's head somebody back to Revelation 8, and let's head somebody else back to Revelation 10. Who'd like to take care of Revelation 8, verse 1? All right, that's going to be Josh, and who'd like to take care of Revelation 10? Revelation 10, verse 7, Steve. Now, as we've said multiple times, we've got the seven seals, we've got the seven trumpets, and we've got the seven plagues. It's been repeatedly said that as we look at these things, we're dealing with the same basic, with the same period of time. First six refer to the Christian era, the seventh after the Lord comes. But as we deal with these three different symbols, we are dealing with three different perspectives or three different angles of the same information. And one of the ways that we can demonstrate that is here in Revelation 16. John says, "It is," what we just read, "it is done, it is finished, it is completed." Notice how when we look at the seals and we look at the trumpets, we've got this same expression used at the same time. Let's go back and look at Revelation 8, verse 1.
When the Lamb opened the seventh seal, there was silence in heaven for about half an hour.
Okay, do you see the parallel? Seventh plague, it is. What did we just read? Revelation 16. Seventh plague, seventh bowl of wrath, it is done. But if we back up and we look at the seventh seal, that first symbol, he says, now there was silence. Silence, done. Different wording, but it is parallel as far as the same basic point. All right, now we've talked about the seventh seal. We've talked about the seventh plague. Let's see how this middle symbol is dealt with. The seventh trumpet, Revelation 10, verse 7. Ah, so Revelation 16, it is done. The seventh seal, there was silence. And now with the seventh trumpet, it's finished. It's done. It's completed. So this is just one of the small parallels that you have between these three, but it is an important parallel because if you can get, as I said, this basic structure down, it will help you greatly. It'll give you at least a basic understanding of at least half, maybe three quarters of the book. All right, since we're dealing with the time where the Lord has come, it's finished, it's done, and so forth, we have, back here in Revelation 16, some information taking place. You have there, in verse 18, information about lightning, plural, voices, thunders, and then there was this great earthquake, which was unlike anything people had ever experienced. And as you go back and you look at the trumpets and the plagues, or the trumpets and the seals, you find these same kinds of images, these same kinds of signs associated with them. When you get to the time when the Lord returns, will anybody have any doubt about what's going on? No. And John here seems to describe that as far as lightning. You think about storms today. We've had some bad lightning recently. We've had some bad winds. Unless you're deaf and unless you're blind, did you have any difficulty in understanding what was taking place as far as a storm? People a lot of times had enough understanding where we need to go down in the basement. We need to find shelter. Well, if you can think about these things on earth that tell us that something serious is taking place, this is a storm, or this is a time where we need to seek shelter, magnifying these things to the point where they're associated with God. When people finally get a chance to come into God's power and presence, I mean, we see lightning. We stand out there, and what's our reaction? See lightning streak across the sky and maybe strike something that's close? What do we think? What word goes through our mind? Yeah. Things like, wow, that's amazing, that's incredible. Well, imagine God. People finally get a chance to, in some sense, see him or have some comprehension of what he is really like, his power and authority and so forth. And that's what John is trying to describe here. When people actually have this experience, it's going to be to a degree that's beyond my ability to describe and maybe beyond our ability to understand. When John spoke of the seventh seal, Revelation 8, verse 1, and that may be a cross-reference you want to go back and look at a little later, but when he speaks about the seventh seal, it's the same deal. He, with that seventh seal, talks about thunder, lightning, and an earthquake, Revelation 8, 1, and also Revelation 8, 5. When he spoke about the seventh trumpet, Revelation 11, verse 5, or Revelation 11, 15, and then you can even look at verse 19, but in Revelation 11, 15, he associates it with thunder, with lightning, and so forth. And once again, when you start putting these together, you begin to see that he's talking about the same times of period, the same time periods and the same basic things, only he's looking at them from different perspectives to fill in a lot of different points that we find elsewhere in the New Testament. Now, in addition to the glory, and I think even the terror for the unsaved, John says something else. He says something about the air. That's in verse 17. The seventh poured out his bowl upon the air. Now, why would he say that? I think we're going to need air after the Lord returns in heaven.
Probably not.
I would suspect we're not going to need air. So why does he say the seventh was poured upon the air? All right. When you think about people today, they're exposed to an air pollen. If people have issues with pollen, if it's in the air, or if you think about a situation where something has exploded, people are concerned about the air because that's able to reach people. So when you think about this symbol, not literally, we're not talking about the air and the earth because the Lord has returned. We're not talking about air in heaven because presumably it's not going to be there. But he's saying that this is going to be something that affects all people. The earth is going to be destroyed, 2 Peter chapter 3, verses 10 through 12, but all people will be affected by the next and final coming of Jesus. The Lord's going to deal with all the unsaved, Satan included, as we talked about from Matthew chapter 25. The unrighteous are going to be subjected to Armageddon, as we talked about in verse 16 and so forth. And, it's just going to be a bad, bad day for folks. There are some people who have different ideas about the earthquake. Some, as they look at that, and remember that John said that it's going to be worse than people have ever experienced in this life. Some think that that's a reference to the terror of that. People today, if they're in, an earthquake that is, 5, 6, 7, 8 on the Richter scale, they're terrified. But John describes that as being far beyond what anybody has ever experienced. And that may be right. As you look at verse 19 ahead a little bit, he talks about the city being divided, and it may be another symbol of, the unsaved, the people who have followed an unrighteous path. They're going to be totally destroyed and overcome. God, it's going to be the undoing for people. But there does seem to be here the idea that unsaved people will be absolutely terrified when the Lord returns. Anything you want to touch base on over what we've said so far? Scott? Well, when we think about the unsaved, we have people in two different categories. There are some unsaved people right now who would be in the Hadean realm. Luke 16, as we think back to the rich man, he's got a pretty good clue that things are not going to go well for him. He may not fully understand, and others there may not fully comprehend what... Right. For those that are alive, they will have missed the time in Hades. So for them, Jesus compared that in the book of Matthew to Noah and the flood. He said the flood came, took them all away. They were surprised. They were eating, drinking. And that seems to be the picture for the second coming, that the Lord will show up for those that are on the earth. They're going to be snatched, as we saw from Revelation 14, and they get tossed into the wine press. So it's kind of like I was in the midst of getting married. I was in the midst of graduating. I was in bed fast asleep. And bang, the next moment I know, here I am before God. and I'm being told that, you know, I'm not in the right relationship with him, and off I go. So bad enough to be in the Hadean realm, but to be here one moment and the next in the presence of an angry God, I just don't know how to describe that. I don't know how to comprehend that. But for the people who are on the earth, and given the earth's population, that would likely be quite a few folks. It's going to be a very, very terrifying experience, but it will be something that a lot of people face.
I just ask that because when it says, later in Revelation, when they said, "Blessed is the Lord who receives you, unclothed, and then unclothed you, when he receives you thirsty, and not giving you drink," like they're surprised that.
Yeah. You have there in Matthew 25 that specific information, and that very well may describe those people that, well, we thought everything was fine, and lo and behold, here we are, and why are we headed off there to hell, Armageddon? Anybody else? All right. Got about 2 minutes left. Let's at least read the rest of the chapter so we can kind of get a picture before us. He says the great city was divided. Well, whatever that city is, and we'll say more about that next week, it's obviously not a good place because of the word division. It was divided into three parts. And the cities of the nations fell, and Babylon the Great was remembered in the sight of God, to give unto her the cup of the wine of the fierceness of his wrath. And every island fled away, and the mountains were not found. And great hail, every stone about the weight of a talent, cometh down out of heaven upon men. And men blaspheme God because of the plague of the hail, for the plague thereof was exceeding great. God has, in his word, gone out of his way to tell people this is the right way, this is the best way to live. But if you do not make this choice, you're going to face a consequence at the end of time that's one that you can't imagine, let alone want to face. So please, 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 do what is right, live for me, give me your life, and I will care for you in ways that you can't imagine.